I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. There's a video produced by Just Not Sports that is shedding light on the hateful and threatening comments sent to women journalists. It features men sitting across from Julie DeCaro and Sarah Spain, who cover sports in Chicago, reading tweets these women have received. Now, I should add, these men were not the authors of these tweets. Here's a clip including many bleeps.
This is why we don't hire any females unless we need our sucked or our food cooked.
Sarah Spain is a self-important know-it-all. Okay.
Just read the tweets, man. There's some mean tweets.
This dumb.
A lot of C word.
There's a lot of C words. Yeah.
Yeah. I hope your dog gets hit by a car, you.
Hopefully this skank Julie DeCaro is Bill Cosby's next victim.
The British publication The Guardian analyzed millions of comments its journalists have received over the last decade and started a series called The Web We Want, looking at patterns in the blocked comments. Joining us is Becky Gardner, who edited the series and is the former comments editor of The Guardian, joining us by Skype. And Becky Gardner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks very much for having me.
Also with us is Daniel Citron, author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. Also, a professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. And Daniel Citron, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be back.
Daniel, let me begin with you and just begin with that video, because listening to it is pretty shocking. Viewing it, it's even more shocking. Do you think making these tweets public allows the public to hear what some of these journalists have to read as they do their job?
You know, I think it's incredibly important. We've seen sort of in the last, really I would say like last 18 months, a public conversation about the kind of online abuse so many people face online, and typically they're women and sexual minorities and people of color. So I think reading that aloud, it was so powerful just to listen to it. And then I think it's sparking a public conversation even more than we've seen before about the kind of abuse that female journalists face and how it impacts their work.
Well, Becky, let me go back to you and go back to what you did at The Guardian. First of all, why this effort to analyze the comments section at The Guardian?
Well, what we felt was that there was a lot of, that there'd been a series of very brave individual women who had started speaking out about the kind of abuse they were getting. And so that had really started a conversation. And then there were a number of surveys which showed that this was quite widespread, not just among journalists, but among the general population. But there seemed to us to be quite a lack of actual data rather than people self-reporting. So, and meanwhile, we had on our system 70 million comments that had been left by readers over a 10-year period. We also knew that our journalists, particularly women, but not only women, complained quite a lot about the kind of comments they got. So we thought we would try and analyse the comments and see if we could inject a bit of sort of hard data in there, if you like. And it was quite surprising what we found.
And you did look at these blocked comments. And I have to say, of the 17 million, about 2% were in the blocked comments category. And I have to say, Becky, I'm surprised it was so little.
Well, when we blocked, I mean, the Guardian site is very well moderated. So people know that they can't come onto the Guardian site and say, use the kind of language that was being read out in that video. We don't get comments like that at The Guardian very, very rarely. What we get are much, so what we're blocking is not necessarily the really extreme end like that. On the other hand, we also try and allow people to have their say. So we don't block everything that we would rather people didn't say to journalists. So the block comments tend to be things that are very dismissive of our writers or ad hominem attacks on our writers. They're things that are not engaging with what the writers are actually writing about, but they're engaging with, you know, they're trying to attack the writer themselves in other ways.
And it sounds like what you focus on are categories of abuse and also disruptive behavior. So comments that would derail a conversation or perhaps have this ad hominem attack of the author, the journalist of whatever article they're commenting on.
Exactly, that's right. And what we found, from what our journalists had told us, and as editor I'd seen it myself, we were expecting to find that women would be given a harder time below their articles. But I was quite surprised by how striking the results were. So as I think you read out before your news programme, of the top 10 opinion writers who got the highest proportion of block comments under their articles, 8 of them were women. 2 of them were black men, and of the 8 women, 3 were not white. So there was a 50-50 split in terms of ethnicity, and 80% of them were women. So that seemed a very strong result, and I was surprised by how clear the result was.
What do you make of that result, Daniel Citron?
You know, it accords with what we see of online harassment, which, you know, is a narrow category of speech and conduct, because it's criminal, tortious, and sort of, I argue, civil rights violations, but we see the same reflection of, you know, a targeting of women disproportionately, a targeting of people of color. Sort of the darker your skin are, women often say the worse it is for online abuse and sexual minorities. So it's unsurprising, and I was so grateful for The Guardian and Becky for engaging in the study to provide more rigor to what, you know, we've seen studies about online harassment that absolutely accord with what The Guardian found, that is disproportionate targeting of women and people of color and sexual minorities. But it is, I think, helpful to have yet another study in which we see the same results, unfortunately, but true.
Becky is joining us from England. We're here in America, Danielle Citron, and we have a First Amendment. I'm actually looking at something that you wrote a couple of years ago, one of those comments on the New York Times. You write, hateful, offensive, and distasteful ideas enjoy constitutional protection, so debate on public issues can be uninhibited, robust, and wide open under the First Amendment. Do people in this country, do they have a right to comment and a right to have those comments published?
Okay, so two different things, right, that you asked. One is, do we have the right to not be thrown in jail or have some sort of government coercion if we are really offensive in our speech, if we're hateful? And the answer to that is we do, right? In our country, the First Amendment protects offensive, hateful, awful speech. And it's because we don't want government to censor ideas, right? Because it's dangerous when government decides what's acceptable and not acceptable. And that's not true, of course, of certain categories of speech that we enjoy no protection, like true threats and defamation of private people. But for hate speech, you know, the government can't put us in jail for saying really hateful and offensive things. But, you know, Marty, your second question was, right, well, what can private companies do? Like, do we have the right to say, hey, private company, you have to leave my speech up if it's, you know, constitutionally protected? And the answer is we don't have that right, right? Private companies, they're not bound by the First Amendment, and they can make a set of choices about the kind of speech that they want on their site. So it's kind of their home and who they invite into their home to speak. And they can decide, as good Samaritans, that they want to remove speech.
Well, let me go back to you, Becky Gardner, and even looking at some of these categories under abuse or disruptive behavior, there's the obviously, you know, threatening comments. I don't think anyone would tolerate that. There's also the author abuse, demeaning and insulting speech that targets a writer, either what they wrote or perhaps something about them. That's something that The Guardian would not tolerate?
That's right, we wouldn't. I mean, I'd like to pick up on what Danielle said, really, which is, you know, we're not a government. The Guardian is a newspaper, and we're trying to foster a community where all our readers feel able to participate and feel part of the conversation. And if some people are shouting other people down, then we want to try and do something about that.
We're having some Skype issues here, but I will carry on. I'm actually looking at an editorial, a piece by The Guardian. The Guardian also blocked ad hominem attacks on both readers and journalist comments, such as, you are so unintelligent. You call yourself a journalist. You get paid for writing this.
Yeah.
Why was that included?
Well, that is included because if you get a thread under an article where some people are trying to discuss the issue which is raised by the article, and other people are simply insulting the journalist in a way which doesn't further the debate in any way at all, it derails the conversation. It stops a good conversation being possible. And if you find as well that those kind of derailing tactics happen more if you're a certain kind of writer, in this case, if you're a female writer, for example, then that's of concern to us.
To you, Daniel Citron, is there, do you think some of these comments, and they run the gamut, have a chilling or can have a chilling effect on what a journalist writes?
You know, I think it does. So, you know, I've been blogging for a long time now, and I can at least say from personal experience that, you know, as human beings, we tend to sort of look at the negative and discount or we credit the positive, but we tend to overly focus on negative comments, and that's just all people. And I think that's true, right? So when you're writing online, you're putting yourself out there and your ideas. And when someone calls you stupid and ugly and various other words that aren't, you know, totally protected speech, but nonetheless are saying, you don't belong here, you're an idiot, your ideas are ridiculous. It does sort of, it can be intimidating. And certainly when it sort of turns to the kind of more threatening, though absolutely veiled, but nonetheless, like you, I think we read in the beginning, someone said, like, you should be, this part of the study, you should be taken out back and shown, you know, what life is like or something. And there are comments that, even if they're not explicitly threatening, but they're demeaning, humiliating, and sort of borderline threatening, it can be chilling for people writing. And I know I've experienced that myself a bit.
You've experienced that yourself, Danielle?
Yeah, yeah.
So how do you deal with it?
You know, it's interesting. I used to blog so much more. And now I just find myself sort of in the position of saying, you know, I really don't have to for my career at this point. I'm very well established in my work. I think I'm just going to write op-eds when invited. It's interesting. Like for some people, they can't make that choice to not blog, write, engage. And that's why I worry about sort of younger people who aren't as well established, who can't make that choice and therefore, you know, are sort of stuck up between a rock and a hard place where they sort of have to engage and it becomes part of, you know, it's not, this is the deal, it's costly, right? Abusive speech, even if it's totally protected speech, can be costly for the people who are at the targets. And so it's these kinds of costs that we say, you look, you can't punish someone for it, but I think it's important to acknowledge, recognize, and you know, bless the Guardian for moderating.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Danielle Citron. She wrote a book called Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. She's also a professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. Joining us by Skype, Becky Gardner. She edited a series at The Guardian called The Web We Want, looking at patterns in blocked comments at The Guardian. And she's former comments editor at The Guardian, joining us, as I said, by Skype. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and we'll hear from a local sports journalist about how she deals with hateful comments, negative comments. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Some journalists have to deal with hateful and threatening tweets, often a part of their job. Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler sat down to talk about online commenting with Sarah Baker. She's co-host of Breakfast on Broad, that's Comcast Network's morning sports show. And Baker recounted the offensive criticisms that she has received over the years while covering sports.
You know, the internet just brings out the worst in people, and I have never been able to figure out why. But they've been consistent, and usually they are not related to anything I'm actually doing. So I've worked in sports since about 2009, and that's really when things, I think, picked up. At first, a lot of them skewed misogynistic. So I would get comments on stories that I would write covering the Flyers on CSNPhilly.com. I remember, gosh, that first season that I should get back into the kitchen, stuff like that. They've morphed now that I'm on air full time about my physical appearance and how, maybe I'm a lesbian or I'm ugly or I have no business on TV, or they go cruder and cruder and cruder from there.
Are these tweets, emails? What are these?
The emails are the least frequent, although I have gotten those, mostly tweets. I see 99.9% of them are tweets. And then I still would say we get occasional comments and messages on Facebook as well through the Breakfast on Broad page, primarily through the CSN Philly page.
How do you respond? Do you engage the person? Do you block them? Do you try not to think about it?
Unlike pretty much everybody else that I know, colleagues in print, online, and broadcast, I don't generally block people unless I feel actually physically threatened, which is rare. Somebody actually asked me this recently, and I went and checked my Twitter block list, and I have maybe a dozen people blocked total, which compared to my colleagues is a fraction of a fraction of a percent of what they do. The reason for that is I think I like to do it differently. I use humor as a weapon. For myself, primarily. It's more about me than about anything else. So usually somebody tweets something mean at me and I say, well, that's not a very nice thing, or I make a joke about it, or I tell them I agree. Like, my favorite thing to do is when someone, Sarah Baker sucks, I say, I know, she's the worst, all of that kind of stuff. That's my go-to. One thing that I do is I actually screenshot the worst of the worst comments that I get on Twitter, Facebook, email, whatever. I save them. I have an email draft in my Gmail called the Email of Jerks, and I keep them all there. Hanging out with friends, I will, you know, we'll periodically pull it out and I'll do dramatic readings of like the worst of the worst that I get. For whatever reason, that's the thing to me that takes 99% of the venom out of them, because they're so ridiculous at the end of the day.
Can you give me an example?
This is a comment from Crossing Broad. That ugly Jew-faced baker should go blow whoever the invented Twitter, because without it, she wouldn't even have a job on Bob, since all she does is read tweets from holes. That's a good one. How about this guy on Twitter? Can Sarah Baker pass a puck with her nose? How about, from Nicole. So this one's from a woman, which is rare. They're usually from men. I really don't like that I'm hearing and seeing more of Sarah Baker recently. Her opinions about the Flyers are laughable and usually wrong. To which somebody replied, I can't stand her voice. And then that original tweeter, Nicole, replied, me neither, and her stupid smile after everything she says. She's the worst. From this person, Sarah Baker looks like an anteater. They're so ridiculous.
Does this ever bother you? Does it ever make you sad, emotional, want to quit TV? And
occasionally. You know, when you're feeling weak. Like, maybe you haven't slept. Maybe you're having a bad day. Maybe you're having an issue elsewhere in your life. You know, you're weak. It happens periodically, right? Yes. I mean, I'm not Teflon. I'm not entirely Teflon. I have to have thick skin, obviously. But yeah, occasionally, like, you feel your heart sink when you see this stuff. And it doesn't last long for me. And part of it is, like I said, I try and take ownership and control of it. But yeah, for sure it hurts. I mean, I'm only human.
And does do you ever talk to your colleagues, male colleagues, about this? Do they get the same sort of reaction? Do they get the same sort of comments about your lack of knowledge about the Flyers, your physical appearance?
Men are not immune from the takedowns on Twitter, certainly. But what I see more with the guys is, you know, that guy, he doesn't know what he's talking about. That guy's an idiot. He's just trying to be a troll. You know, his opinions are bad. They're not telling them that they look like anteaters or, you know, ugly Jew face, whatever. Those, I don't see that stuff happening to my male colleagues, although I'm sure it might happen to some somewhere. It's not as personal. It's different. And I have met some of my trolls in the past. And when I meet them in person, they are always unbelievably nice and kind. They buy me drinks. They bring me gifts. They say, you know, I was hard on you. I didn't mean it.
That's Sarah Baker, co-host of Breakfast on Broad, Comcast Network's morning sports show here in Philadelphia, talking with Radio Times producer Elizabeth Fiedler. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. And let me just quickly reintroduce our guest, Daniel Citron, author of a book called Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, a professor of law at the University of Maryland Law School. Becky Gardner edited a series at The Guardian called The Web We Want, a former comments editor at The Guardian, joining us by Skype from England to join our conversation. Let me go to you, Daniel. What's so interesting, what we hear Sarah Baker say at the very end of the interview is that when she meets these guys in person, in flesh, and they meet her, they couldn't be nicer. What does that tell us?
It's so typical, right? So we've heard this, and you know, journalists always report. Interestingly, you know, we've seen Sports Illustrated writers say the same thing. Men, that they, when they finally confront or meet their harassers or abusers, they feel terrible. They say, the internet got the best of me. And that's precisely what the reporter found, right? That that when confronted with people's humanity and their pain, right, and that they're real people who bleed, right, that they catch themselves, that is, the person who's spoken the abuse, feels terrible because they see it's a real person that they're attacking. It's not like words and images, but it's someone who suffers or could suffer, right? And so what the phenomenon that we see, why does the internet bring out the best and the worst in us, is because we feel disinhibited, that what we have this sense when we're behind a screen that what we say and do won't hurt anybody, that we're kind of not accountable. We can't see people's reactions and pain, and so it seems that it's not going to hurt anybody. It's just in the ether and the internet. And so when people are confronted with real people who, you know, could be hurt, they feel terrible. It sort of brings the humanity back into the calculus.
Becky, let me go back to you, and then we'll get some callers in on the conversation. Your former comments editor at The Guardian. So while a lot of these comments were not, probably most of them, or maybe even all of them, were not directed to you per se, I'm thinking about the job of the moderator and what the effect is of going through some of these hateful tweets. Now, maybe people are more well-behaved in England than they are here in the United States, but is there stress associated with a job like this?
Well, there's sort of two parts to that. But one is, when I was comments editor, it's what you would call opinion editor. So I was commissioning the journalists who were writing the
piece. I got you.
So I wasn't a moderator. The moderators I know do suffer stress, definitely. And it's one of the several things that we're looking at The Guardian at the moment, is how to help moderators cope with that stress better. And we're doing some work around that at the moment. In terms of my particular job there, I mean, it was going back to something we were talking about earlier about the sort of chilling effect, is I would made a very concerted effort to try and get more women writing opinion pieces, because famously opinion pages are very male dominated, and it is extremely difficult. And often women say they don't want to write because they don't want the reception that they get afterwards. So I mean, it's an anecdotal thing, but I would say there definitely is a chilling effect, that some women don't want to expose themselves to that kind of treatment.
Now, going back to The Guardian, I mean, obviously you're blocking comments to The Guardian. Are you saying that a troll can track down an opinion writer and find out their personal Twitter account and get to them that way?
Well, they do that, of course. Yes. So all we can moderate is what happens on The Guardian's own site. We don't have control over what people then say about the pieces on and the journalists on Twitter. And of course, the bigger problem is there, that a lot of The Guardian journalists find that they then get worse abuse on Twitter and other social media platforms.
And Becky, I'm curious about the web we want. What's been the response from your readers at The Guardian?
It's been absolutely amazing, actually, because one of the things that we did was we asked readers whether they left comments on the site themselves or whether they just read them or whatever. We asked readers what they felt and what they would like to see happen. And we're in the process at the moment of reading the enormous postback that we got as a result. So we had about 2,000 people, readers took the trouble to fill in quite a lengthy sort of document where we ask them lots of questions about what they'd like to see. And we're sort of in the process of going through that at the moment. We will publish what they say. But what we found was a really high level of engagement from readers who love the ability to comment, and they love reading the comments, and they don't want this kind of behaviour below the line on The Guardian either. And you know, that was a very heartening part of it, is that the readers also don't want to see this stuff.
Becky, are there clever trolls?
A lot of trolls are clever, and they're even sometimes funny. I mean, some of the stuff that was just being read out is sort of on one level quite funny, but it's become so common and it's so everywhere. It's sort of the joke wears thin after a while.
Danielle, let me turn back to you, and since you are our law professor, talking about this, what is that line that gets crossed from, you know, hateful comments, demeaning comments, to something that is actually criminal? Of course, we're talking about here in the United States.
So when speech involves certain categories of speech that we say either enjoy no protection or much less rigorous protection, that's when we, as a, you know, in the way that we approach it, courts approach it, would say, look, that's not protected speech, and that crosses the line. So it would include speech that is threatening, that, you know, makes a true or credible threat it's speech that's defamatory, that spreads, you know, factual falsehoods about someone, in especially for private people who, you know, don't enjoy a public audience. It includes speech that's crime facilitating, like extortion or solicitation. And it also includes, and this might be an interesting topic for maybe another segment, but it could be today, but, you know, the public disclosure of private facts like nude photos or sex videos, like we saw in the Hulk Hogan case. And it's that kind of speech that we say, look, that crosses the line. Doesn't mean the line is easy to figure out. There are always gray cases, and there are cases that we're going to debate about, and we don't have clear answers, but at least we know the set of speech that we're talking about.
Well, I wonder whether things like, I mean, death threats. I can't walk up to you, Danielle, on the street. I don't think I can, and say I want to kill you. Is that protected speech online?
Right. So true threats are not protected on or offline. How we figure out what a true threat is we look at the context. We look at how it was said, who said it, what's the relationship, what's the sort of broader context in which that speech is said. And so it sounds like, Marty, when let's say someone goes up to someone and says, I'm going to kill you, if they're not laughing and smiling, what's something we think about and would say, look, that's a true threat. The person had a very serious face. The recipient took it as a true threat, was terrorized. It changed how they lived their lives. So, you know, it's not that there are easy answers to any given factual scenario, but at least, you know, we know the kinds of questions, and we certainly know that true threats on or offline, it's the same set of questions. There's no exception for the internet. Like, you can say whatever you want.
Well, let me get some callers in on the conversation. Looks like we have Will from Wayne, Pennsylvania. And Will, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. It sounds like most of this discussion is centered around how women are engaging with this on a professional or intellectual forums. But I'm also familiar with how this harassment can extend into personal scenarios. I have a friend who tried OkCupid and then made a joke about posting some of the most egregious messages she got from men. And some of them are absolutely terrifying, but she's responded with, that's just stuff that happens. Or there was a case study that had been making the rounds on the internet where a man decided that he would take a photograph of a relatively attractive friend of his, go on to various websites and declare himself that this is him. And he ended his case study months earlier than he anticipated because he was legitimately afraid of some of the messages he was getting in response.
Well, that's fascinating. Becky, I know that you didn't look at dating sites per se, but it sounds like a similar finding from what you found at The Guardian.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly can't really comment on dating sites, although I have heard friends of mine too have had similar experiences from that of your caller. I think dating sites are certainly a site of where women often find themselves abused online.
And Becky, I'm curious about whether there are particular topics, at least for The Guardian, maybe even news topics, that generate hateful comments.
Well, that was one of the things that was very interesting, is it really didn't matter what women were writing about. They got more block comments regardless of subject. And that subjects which were, obviously, the more controversial the subject, like if you're writing about Israel-Palestine, then you're going to get a higher proportion of block comments. But even there, the women got more than the men. And then when there were things which were don't attract a lot of block comments, like, you know, less controversial subjects like rugby, say, still women got loads more block comments than men. So it really, it didn't, although there were subjects that were more sensitive than others, the fact that women got a higher proportion would cut across that.
Let me get David from Central New Jersey to join us on Radio Times. David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Marty. Sure. I was once told that there are two countries in which the use of fighting words is against the law, and those countries are the U.S. and Israel. And I wanted to ask your guest if that's true and how it would apply. Thank you.
You're welcome, David. Thanks for the call. Danielle, can you take that?
Sure. It's true that in the United States there's a category of speech that falls outside the protection of the First Amendment, and that's fighting words. But fighting words have to provoke imminent violence. So, you know, the example we have is someone walks up to a police officer and says something so inflammatory that the only response can be sort of a punch in the face. Maybe I shouldn't use the example of a police officer, but famous case. But the idea of a fighting word is that there can be no conversation. There's no speech that it can intervene that can prevent the violence that will then ensue. And so often, you know, we think of online speech and the way in which it can harass and defame and invade privacy. And it's not the same. That is, you don't have that face-to-face interaction in which there's no room for kind of counter speech and conversation that would warrant a punch in the face. So fighting words are interesting, but they're really less applicable in what we're talking about.
Vicki, I know you have to leave us in about a minute or so. And I'm curious whether you have some concerns that the blocked comments might be overly inclusive. And by that, I mean comments, dismissive trolling, things like, calm down, dear, including that in some of the comments that would be blocked. Is there a concern that you're shutting down a potentially fruitful conversation?
Is it my concern? No, it's not my concern. I don't think that saying calm down, dear, is helping a potentially fruitful conversation. I mean, it is important to say I also wouldn't count that as abuse,
right,
and
right.
Certainly wouldn't count it as hate speech. But I don't think it's a useful contribution to a conversation. And I think it's very deliberately put there to try and derail the conversation.
And the goal for The Guardian?
Sorry, what was that?
The goal?
The goal for The Guardian. I think we were interested in just looking at this issue, trying to contribute some data to the issue. I think it would be fantastic if other digital sites followed The Guardian's lead and started being more open about what was happening on their own site. I think it's very important. And then there's the next thing we're going to try and do is look at ways at helping our journalists be more resilient, helping them find ways of coping with the problem.
Well, Vicki Gardner, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times. Edited The Guardian's The Web We Want series and has conducted research for the series along with a colleague. She's a senior lecturer at Goldsmiths University of London, the former comment editor at The Guardian. Danielle Citron staying with us for the rest of the hour. Much more to talk about. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Danielle Keats-Citron about hate comments, whether they come in through a newspaper or a media site or directed at journalists or, frankly, at others as well. You can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You can also call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Danielle, let me go back to something that you found, that between 2010 and 2013, there were 2.5 million cases of cyber stalking. And one of the critiques in your book is that police departments just don't seem to have either the personnel or perhaps even the knowledge to be able to address the problems of cyber stalking. There were 10 cases, I think, in federal courts. That information might be a little bit dated. But if there are 2.5 million cases of cyber stalking, how can any police department would deal with that number?
Right. And even if it's, let's say it's considerably less than that, let's just suppose that it's, as the Bureau of Justice Statistics estimated, that it's like 850,000 a year. Let's just assume that. Okay, let's like take a lowball estimate, because you're right, there have been definitely higher estimates. You're right, it would overwhelm law enforcement. So, you know, I argue and urge state and local law enforcement to take an important oar. You know, the federal government can't do it all. We've seen that they are, you know, they will tell victims, look, this isn't a question of national security. Go contact state and local police. And so given that the natural inclination, you know, for federal agents is to sort of say, look, we have very scarce resources. We have to devote that to them, to other kinds of crimes, that the hope is that state and local law enforcement get sort of better training and perhaps by, you know, federal government employees with more sophisticated sort of take and understanding of technical tools. I think an important thing is to have local and state law enforcement on the case. They were first on the beat, you know, when we had stalking laws, they came from the states. So California passes the first stalking law in 1990, and then within 3 years, all 50 states follow. So I think if we're going to see real change and results, I'd love to see some movement at the federal level, like federal law enforcement bringing more cases. And I think we're increasingly seeing a little bit more, right? It's not completely unusual to see cases brought under the federal cyber stalking law, but it still, of course, remains quite rare. So, you know, attorney generals like the AG of California, Kamala Harris, has been on this beat in the last 2 years. She wants to get more training to law enforcement. She has, you know, put up a cyber exploitation hub sort of to teach law enforcement and victims about the problem of online harassment and revenge porn. And so I think we've seen some gratifying moves, but, you know, the problem will never be addressed by law completely. You know, your question is like, can law enforcement really deal
sure.
with just thousands or millions of harassment cases, right? Totally right. Law is a blunt instrument. It can only and really should only do so much. But at the very least, we need to bring some threat of, you know, of criminal convictions so that we have any deterrence. Because if we think that there's no consequences, right, what's to stop people?
But I'm also thinking, I mean, the internet, I'm old enough to remember when it was a brand new thing and people were all gaga about it. And I'm still in many ways gaga about the internet. But yeah. The idea that we would create this environment where people can talk and it would be a true democracy, that I do believe still exists. And now there's this part of the internet that is a place where people can anonymously threaten people, send hateful email, make derogatory comments about their appearance and all of that. But can we not use, I guess, the sort of mob mentality of the internet to go after some of these trollers?
Oh, that's an interesting thought. I mean, just to comment on your earlier insight about kind of our kind of utopian view of the internet, I think, you know, we've now come to an understanding of the internet or network tools are like everything else, you know, so that if you could have, right, harassment and stalking in real space and fraud and, you know, defamation, we can have it online, right? We're just human beings behind the screen. So in some ways, like, I think we've just been brought back down to reality, and I'm with you in remembering those kind of early exciting days of the internet. Anyone could be a dog. You could be and do anything. But we've come to realize it's just like any tool that we use. It's going to have the same sort of biases and problems that we face in real life. We're going to face them, of course, you know, via network tools. But the question is, you know, that you asked, which is interesting, is like, what can we do to have all of us be part of the solution? No, Marty was asked the question about, like, can we sort of fight back in some way
right.
to bring the mobs against harassers and stalkers, right, or abuse? And I think the answer is we could, right, especially as we see moderators on sites, either social networks or, you know, like on The Guardian, where what we're doing is we could harness the crowds to vote down comments that are destructive. I mean, if that's the ethos of the community. So we certainly see it sometimes on Yik Yak, which is a totally anonymous tool. But you'll go on campus for college campuses, and there'll be instances of hate speech that get voted down by the community, where people think, you know what, not on my mile and a half radius, right? This is our campus. We don't want to see that kind of hate speech. And it's true that we can harness the crowds to do really pro-social things. And to be more supportive of people and to vote down hateful, destructive speech. But of course, we know these tools are going to be used by mobs to do the opposite, mm-hmm. right? And then the question is it worth the cost? I always think, like, think of the cost-benefit analysis. So if you're getting engaged in a positive campaign, just make sure you're not putting yourself in danger. I've seen, and I write about in my book, about how friends of harassment victims try to, in some sense, engage in counter speech and protect victims, and they end up being victims themselves, right? Because they put their neck out in their own name, they end up being next in line, right, for abuse. So that's my worry. You know, I think we should be involved and engaged in counter speech, but be careful.
Let me read a couple of comments here. One from Cindy. She says, I wonder if people were required to have their full name disclosed on the internet if hate speech wouldn't be dramatically reduced. An email from Tom. Isn't tweeting, et cetera, only the most recent manifestation of anonymous rage? People have been sending nasty comments through mail and other media for some time. A Facebook comment from Tudor. I've modified my opinion on this. I used to be against any kind of moderation that basically makes threads and sites unusable, yards and yards of empty abuse, racism, and BS on some sites. It does nothing to advance debate or knowledge, still protected speech in public spaces, though, in my view. And this is this, I think, back and forth about certainly in this country, Danielle, which is, you know, wanting a place where people can say hateful things and you know, countering that speech with a different kind of speech.
Right, and whether real names will help us bring out our better selves and less of the destructive part, as the questioner asked, or if this is, even with real names, like we're going to have it anyway, as the second questioner asked. Like, right, like, hey, Twitter is no different from mail, is no different from, you know, any other means in which, hey, we're going to say really destructive things and there's nothing we can do about it. I mean, you know, so as to the first question about real names, right. I always worry about that suggestion because I always think of when we require people's real names, it also applies to the political dissenter, the domestic violence victim, right? People for whom anonymity is both indispensable for their own safety as well as indispensable for their ability to speak truths about themselves and the world around them. So, you know, we have to, I think, recognize the downside of requiring people's real names. Now, can sites revoke people's privilege to write anonymously? Absolutely. They're private parties. And sometimes, you know, if we think about it, maybe anonymity or pseudonymity is sort of a privilege that you can lose with harassment, stalking, and destructive speech, right? You know, does the internet reflect who we are? The second question, absolutely, right? So that we're seeing destruction that we see, you know, with different vehicles, whether it's mail or other forms of telephone, right? But that doesn't mean that there's not something that's different about the internet. It's different because it's more lasting. It spreads further and wider, right? We can Google something that, like you said, a destructive thing by, like, you made phony phone calls in eighth grade, you know, like telephone harassment.
Been there, done that, yes.
Right? So sorry to, like, almost make a confession about myself. But, yeah. Right, but the sort of old school 1980 version of ways in which we would bother people, but they were one and done for the most part. Right. You couldn't years later Google, let's say, let's pretend that someone on a phone call says something defamatory, which we do all the time. But let's say someone, if we put that online, it's searchable and persistent and maybe prominent when we look for someone on them, you know, in a Google search of their name, it's part of their then permanent CV or at least permanent for some time. Right. And so what I think a caution that we have about network tools is part of what we think is so amazing about them is that they reach so many people, that they bring groups together from all really disparate places on the globe, that they have speech that has lasting power and that's searchable and that will persist and we have a record of it. So in some respects, that is, we need to think about solutions that account for those differences and ways in which we can both really hurt people and help people in much more exaggerated or exponentially more harmful ways.
Well, let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We have Lisa from Wallingford joining us. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. And Danielle, you and I know each other. I am a law professor here in Philadelphia. And I have say that making this call is a very scary thing for me to do. But I respect Danielle's work enormously. I, for the past year, have been the victim of internet bullying.
Really?
And I want to pass on one additional perspective. And Danielle, you just referred to sort of your Google record. But I have teenage children. And as a result of my having been bullied on the internet, my children in public school have been bullied. And I get calls from the guidance counselor saying, you know, this happened today. We're dealing with it. And I also think a lot about my children Googling me and what they would come up with and how hard that is for them to handle. And so it's not just about the victim herself. It also has a huge ripple effect. And it also has a feeling for the victim of you never know when the next thing is going to crop up on the internet. And you get calls from your friends saying, listen, be calm, but this happened today. Mm-hmm. And it's really life-changing, life-altering for the victim and for her family.
Lisa, I know this is a complicated story. Do you know who your bully is, who's bullying you online?
Yes, I do. I was the subject of a tabloid story several years ago that then was picked up by the international media.
Well, I really appreciate you calling into Radio Times. Danielle, anything you want to say to, and clearly you two know each other, to Lisa's story, and then we'll get back to our callers.
And I really appreciate Lisa sharing it, because it's so often that when you experience online abuse, and then, of course, it has that ripple effect on your family because it's searchable, not only in your own names, but perhaps in your kids, it could be connected to your kids. It shows that the damage is spreads far and wide, right? It's not just the victim, but victim's family. And so talking about it is a brave thing to do, right? Because it helps, I think it really is so important because it's helped educate us, but it shows just how harmful it can be, not only to yourself, right, to a victim, but to the loved ones, right? We see it in Lisa's case. We see it in Zoe Quinn's case and why she eventually urged law enforcement to drop her, the prosecution against her ex who was stalking her and inspiring so many people, because she just said, look, every time my ex goes in front of the court and there's another matter, the mob goes after me, right? It's an inspiration, not to the stalker, not to the original person, but to the supporting mob. And she just said, like, enough's enough, because the abuse not only was suffered by her, but her family members, her boyfriend, all these people around her were targeted, docked, swatted, so that it became not only victim, but the net of the victims, as Lisa, I think, so poignantly put it, is like much wider.
Well, Lisa, I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me get one more caller on. This is Jules from Doylestown. And Jules, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Lottie. Hi, pleasure, as always.
Thank you.
I wanted to relate an experience and get your take on the use of unexpected forms and really wildly inappropriate forms for egregious speech. I go to YouTube from time to time to listen to music. I wanted to hear the soundtrack from Schindler's List, which, of course, is a Holocaust story. And on YouTube, there's a comment section for the music, and it's usually, I like this performance, or I've played this piece in high school. And this was used for some of the most egregious, horrifying, surprising anti-Semitic comments, Holocaust denial, and all this kind of thing on a YouTube music site. So I wanted to get your thoughts on the use of really so wildly inappropriate spaces to use for this kind of speech.
Jules, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Danielle, unfortunately, we have about a minute before I have to say goodbye to you. Go ahead.
So, no, I mean, we see anti-Semitic speech. We see racist speech. It's unsurprising that it's literally everywhere and in unexpected places. So thanks for the call.
Yeah, no, Jules, thanks for the call. But just a quick follow-up there. I mean, obviously Jules didn't expect it, didn't want to see it, is offended by it. Does it, though, Danielle, do people have a right to comment on Schindler's List music and make anti-Semitic remarks?
I mean, so YouTube's community guidelines would probably, if you reported it, remove it or at least address it because they ban hate speech. And they might define hate speech, I think, broadly as demeaning, humiliating speech.
Jules, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Danielle Keats-Citron, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And she's the author of a book called Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. She's also a law professor at the University of Maryland. We began the conversation talking with Becky Gardner. She has headed up a series at the Guardian newspaper, The Web We Want. And we also heard from local sportscaster Sarah Baker. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. In fact, we posted that video that we played, that YouTube video at the very top of the show. We posted that on our Facebook page, and we're curious about your comments on that. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.